Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Disruptors, an IFT podcast that brings you the latest insights and perspectives from some of the brightest minds in the science of food. Each episode, our guests discuss the ever-changing intersection of entrepreneurship, innovation, and science and their role in advancing the global food system. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden. On today's podcast, we will discuss global connectedness, including the complexities of both economies and supply chains, as well as what it means to be a global citizen. We'll explore the rapid changes taking place in light of COVID-19, and also what recent emerging trends could mean, particularly as they relate to work and the food system. Speaking with me today is April Rinney, globally minded advisor, speaker, writer, and authority on the new economy, future of work, and global citizenship, and Maria Villasario, chief science and technology officer of the Institute of Food Technologists. April will be IFT's keynote speaker for the IFT 20 virtual event scheduled this July 13th through 15th. Thanks so much for being with me today, both of you.
Thank you, Matt. I'm delighted to be here.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So, April, you've written extensively on the new economy. So I'm curious, could you share a few major global trends that you anticipate for 2020 and beyond? And of course, right now, I'm particularly interested in the international impact of COVID-19.
Sure, Matt. Thank you again. And it's a great question to tee up our conversation today. Also, because there are so many trends. You know, there are economic trends, social trends, policy trends, political trends, trends related to health, food, and sort of the list goes on. I do think it's important to keep in mind that many of these trends that I'll talk about and we'll talk about today, I think, were already in place pre-COVID-19. Mm. But what we're seeing is that COVID-19 in many ways has been a sort of accelerant. Things are playing out faster. In some cases, these trends are playing out more intensely than would have otherwise been the case. So a couple of the big ones, you know, in terms of global economic trends, the biggest ones that I see stem from the fact that we're realizing more than ever just how interconnected and interdependent that we are, and how painful pausing or disrupting these connections, even temporarily, can be. So on the one hand, we see pretty much a dampening, if not an outright halt, of a lot of international everything. I think particularly, you know, travel and tourism. We see airlines are down 95% from 3 months ago. Trade and supply chains are challenged on the whole. That's not unique to food. That's really across the industrial spectrum. I think, you know, manufacturing we look at, it's been very much hampered. And even when places start to open up, as we're starting to see with China, they find that, you know, customers aren't necessarily there. And that's especially the case when those customers are international. Hmm. So, you know, personally, I typically work in about 20 different countries a year, not this year, right? It has both a sort of organizational level and a societal level impact, but also I think individually, a lot of professionals are being affected as well. But on the other hand, I want to point out that while we're seeing this kind of contraction internationally in terms of a lot of commerce and trade and so forth, on the other hand, we are seeing incredible international cooperation and even in some ways solidarity when it comes to COVID-19. You know, it's almost as though we have a common borderless enemy to fight, and we're coming together in ways that we wouldn't typically otherwise. So, you know, how that plays out, we'll see in terms of the race for a vaccine and so forth. But we're sort of seeing both sides, the flip sides of the same coin. Now, I also see from an economic perspective that we're in a few different ways heading towards a more, I would call it, regional approach, a more regional networks, whether that's regions of a given country or regions of the world. And that's a trend that I expect to persist because we're looking at scale larger than simply local, but a little bit safer, you could say, than strictly global. And then I think the trend, the economic trend that is certainly, it's sort of the elephant in the room, is the just enormous upward trend right now in unemployment figures worldwide. And I hesitate to call that a long-term trend because we just don't know yet. But regardless, it will have a huge effect on how other economic and social trends play out. So when I turn and look briefly at some of the social and cultural trends. I think the biggest ones that I see are, you know, how we work and, you know, work from home. Used to be, I've been focused on the future of work for quite some time now, and used to give, I'm guessing I still will give, keynotes on things like remote work and distributed work, and it would always sort of raise eyebrows. I don't think that's going to be the case anymore.
Yeah.
Also, you know, how we're spending our time, more cooking, more gardening, more time with family. I find it interesting that previously there was a lot of focus on optimization of every second. That's not really happening as much anymore. Now, I guess the big questions, though, the really for me revolve around what happens next. You know, these are trends that we're seeing right now that I think will persist into much of 2020 and beyond. But we really have to see, how does reopening go? Do we experience relapses? You know, how much work from home? We know it will be more than it was before, but people are hardwired to be social, whether that's professionally or just, you know, in our personal and family lives. And so virtual is okay in a bind, but it still has its limits. And so I think that the direction and the magnitude of some of these trends, we will be living through that in the coming months. But the ones that, you know, I just sort of spelled out big picture are where we want to look to better understand the path ahead.
That's really interesting. And I do want to touch on this global aspect that you mentioned. I mean, you talk about working in tens of different countries over the course of a year, and obviously that is going to be a shift in work for you. But this idea of global citizenship, so you describe yourself as a global citizen, and I'm wondering if you can give me a little bit of an idea of what you mean by that. And then also talk about the role of global citizenship and how it plays into climate change and the role of regional economies. And how does the food system tie into that?
Yeah, what an amazing question. So I'll try to keep this brief. I will admit I could talk about it all day. But to tee things up, I think let me just spend a minute talking about what global citizenship is and isn't as I see it. So, you know, when I say global citizenship, I don't mean carrying a bunch of passports or traveling a lot or speaking many languages. I also don't mean multinational companies. The term citizen itself is tricky because for many people today, it implies a passport, or borders, or the census, you know, immigration and so forth. But the fact is, you know, I've talked to lots of people about what's a better term. And there isn't one right now. I wish, you know, we could say humans, but, or humanity, because that's really what binds us together as people on the globe. But, you know, I've kind of acknowledged that citizen is still the best term that we've got, even though I'd like to think that 10 years from now, we have a better phrase for what I'm about to describe. So when I say global citizenship, what I do mean, I'm really talking about our values, our priorities, and fundamentally what it means to recognize our interdependence as humans in the world today. So increasingly, we're facing borderless challenges. That includes, you know, climate change, intolerance, a pandemic. These are all borderless challenges, but we don't really have borderless solutions yet. And we often remain stuck within our borders, and whether those borders are geopolitical or mental, whether they're imposed by somebody else or whether they're of our own creation. So I like to say that global citizenship sees beyond these borders, and it understands that as humans, we share far more in common than that which divides us. So you could think of this as an ethos of we rather than me first. You might've heard that. It's also for me a celebration of diversity, collaboration, and a knowledge that diverse systems are actually also the most resilient. So when it comes to regional economies and the food system, I think of global citizenship in a few different ways. On the one hand, it's an understanding, a sort of an appreciation and a celebration of other cultures and also other cuisines. It's also a deep desire to genuinely listen to and learn from locals in whatever part of the world you happen to be in. Because I find in my work and travels globally, like, there is just so much we can learn from one another. Now, that said, at the same time, I think global citizenship and this sense of interdependence and this sense of borderless challenges, it also lands us with an understanding of the effects of our actions. So with regards to the food system, you know, this means eating locally whenever possible, making food choices with lower environmental impact. Now, more broadly, when we look at how this could play out, not just with regards to the food system and business models, but business more broadly, this really has an impact on how we could think about how we structure our economy moving forward. And I think, I'm guessing that some people who are listening today may have heard of what's called stakeholder capitalism. So this is capitalism that takes into account the needs of all stakeholders, so workers, suppliers, the communities that you serve, rather than simply looking at this from the perspective of investment and shareholder return. So I like to say that global citizenship is actually much more aligned with a stakeholder approach. I also acknowledge that's probably a whole other topic. So there's more I could say, but I'll pass it back to you.
Well, and I think, you know, it's so interesting. You talk about COVID-19 as an accelerator. And as you were speaking, I was thinking through the COVID-19 lens, as is impossible not to do during this time, right? And you have parts of maybe the global citizenship aspect might be more challenging, such as, you know, gaining access to listen, you know, more intensely to locals and things like that. But I think I almost wonder if it can accelerate some of the ideals that global citizenship is all about.
Absolutely. I mean, from my perspective, it's this sense, and I don't like using the term enemy, but if we think about COVID as this common borderless enemy that is hitting people and communities, regardless of where you live, regardless of how much you earn, it really is. It's incredibly, how do I say this? I mean, it's destabilizing for sure, but it also is bringing people together in ways that wouldn't have happened before. Right. And I've had many conversations recently, actually. This is a little bit of a tangent, but I'm used to being, people often call me a sort of cross-cultural bumblebee, where I'm cross-pollinating ideas and traveling in a lot of different places and so forth. And that's hard to do when we can't travel. And yet the need for and the value of cross-cultural pollinators, if you will, in a virtual world, I think is going to start to be even more important, because we're waking up to this recognition of just how interdependent we are, and we need to maintain those ties. But if we relied on those ties being through physical travel in the past, we're going to need some virtual equivalents. And so I think, you know, it just gets really interesting in terms of opening up opportunities, possibly roles, possibly, you know, who knows, platforms and businesses and so forth that didn't exist before to meet this need.
Right. Well, and I do want to bring in Maria here. So Maria, as a food scientist, I imagine that you also have a unique perspective on this concept of global citizenship and its role in our planet's sustainability. What are your thoughts here?
This is an incredibly complex topic, but it's a topic that touches upon so many aspects of food and the science of food. I would like to start by talking a little about the complexity of our food system. Our food system is very developed, very sophisticated, but at the same time, it is facing very serious global challenges. And we're going through transformations that they are generational in nature. We're going through chronic issues like climate change and trade, and we're experiencing some very acute pains like the pandemic that we're going through right now, or extreme weather phenomena. And as we see the climate and environmental changes rise, we also see a correlation with geopolitical tensions. We are going through a population growth that continues to accelerate and puts a lot of pressure on demand for food. And when we need more food, we need to grow our global trade, and which makes us more dependent upon one another. Also, we are seeing a number of changes with consumers and societies. It's amazing to see the spread of global cuisine. What used to be aspirational in the past and exotic for many of us, it has now become very much within reach. We see global cuisines moving and while they're moving from one place of the planet to the other, we're also seeing a merge of consumer choices and options that people exercise. But all of this is happening while we are experiencing a lot of food insecurity. Mm. And food insecurity is rife among the urban poor, the rural poor, and the agrarian poor around the world. And the other thing that is important to mention here, it is actually the regulations and the protection policies that are asymmetrical in nature and imbalanced. So among all of this complexity, we are seeing changes that are driven by consumers and societies as well as policymakers. And we are seeing more transparency on where the food is coming from. People want to know what's in their food, because they want to manage their health and wellness and have better outcomes. And also, we see a value that we put in actually feeding the world and making sure that we are reducing, we're eliminating the inequalities and the terrible consequences that malnutrition has later in life. So all of this is a very complex, it's a great environment for scientists from many different colors to actually work in and drive outcomes. I want to talk a little about the science of food and the very important role that food scientists play in all this. It's really it's been a tremendous effort to make food safer, to make food more nutritious, to make food more available and more affordable. And what we see more and more is we see more of the formation of an intersection between science and technology, which is inevitable. But I do want to highlight here how important it is to understand that science does not work in isolation. Science does not work in a vacuum. And in the context of global citizenship, science has always transcended borders, but scientists do not operate in a vacuum.
Well, and I'm curious on both of your thoughts here as well. You know, what, especially in light of the current pandemic situation, what are the challenges and opportunities that are there and emerging that might have a direct impact on the sustainability of our planet's food supply? April, I'll start with you.
Yeah, this is such a great, and again, another complex question. And I'm going to pick up on a couple of themes that Maria mentioned as well. So I should give a caveat, I guess, at the outset, is that I'm someone who tends to see challenges as opportunities in disguise. So I sort of, again, see these as two sides of the same coin. From where I stand, the single biggest challenge that I see in the here and now is the fragility of our, you know, largely industrial consumer-facing systems. Now, this is not just the food system. There are many systems that relate to food, you know, such as transportation, that are also proving to be quite fragile in the face of COVID-19. And that doesn't mean that we don't have good infrastructure. We have very good infrastructure. But when there's a human health hazard and you don't want to get on any form of public transportation, for example, that creates a series of ripple effects. So we've built the infrastructure that tends to be big and centralized, which is strong, but it turns out it's not very nimble in times of shock. Now, I focus a lot on the future of work and, you know, on many levels, who's working, how we're working, where we're working, etc. And it's increasingly clear to me that many of our current food system challenges aren't so much about food as they are about people. Now, here in the US, and again, this isn't specific to food, but it plays out in some really interesting ways. So we have a labor market and a labor force and a set of labor policies that over time have developed so that, you know, health insurance attaches to a job rather than a person. So when you have the number of people we have right now losing their job, that's not just about loss of livelihood, that's about loss of healthcare protection. And this isn't intended to be political in any way, shape, or form. I mean, we could take this conversation to pretty much any country, and you realize, what does it mean to have a large chunk of the population whose health is in a precarious situation, right? Now, this is the U.S., And I really want to keep this in global context so we can head to emerging markets and this kind of precariousness and fragility becomes really clear. So the World Bank estimates, most recent estimate last week, that half, now I'm not, like, this is not a typo, half of all jobs across sub-Saharan Africa are expected to be lost due to COVID-19. Whoa. Now, I've worked across Africa. I've managed teams across Africa. I have tremendous respect for all of the 54 countries on the continent. It's not just one place. But I will admit, I still can't wrap my head around the magnitude of this figure. And as you know, this is also where there's just extreme food poverty already. So bringing this back, not just to IFT and food science and the role of food science, technology, and innovation, but, you know, it's interesting. I recognize that the future of work is a very different topic from food science and from IFT's mission per se, but I actually think that there is a huge opportunity for food system stakeholders as a whole to become more proactive around the future of work moving forward. You know, this isn't just food producers. This is also food services, right? Which is one of the largest sources of employment in the US and in any country in the world. And so I think about, wow, okay, if we're looking at a fragile system and one of the weakest points or, you know, the greatest sources of fragility relate to people and human safety, not necessarily food safety, although they are related, that to me opens up also, it's a huge challenge. It's also a really big opportunity for how the food system and food system stakeholders as a whole look at their roles moving forward. So, you know, that's one piece that I look at. Another piece to echo Maria is food poverty. Again, related to what I was just talking about, but also its own issue on its own with or without COVID. But again, just another really sobering statistic. According to the World Food Program, it's expected that food poverty will double this year compared to 2019. That's 265 million people worldwide. Right. And obviously, food poverty is an economic issue. It's a supply chain issue. It's also a distribution issue. And again, you know, lots of distribution challenges, again, both domestic and global in scope. But I still think this is a huge opportunity for the food system as a whole to rethink how we're producing, supplying, and distributing food, you know, and I know that we could quickly probably go down a very deep rabbit hole here. but I'm looking at this from the perspective of everything from, you know, regenerative business models and not just agriculture, but regeneration as a concept. I'm looking at what would it mean to invest more in regional food systems. I will say, I think that the recent stimulus funding package here in the U.S., it was a huge missed opportunity in this regard, in that a lot of the smaller food producers didn't share in a lot of the bounty of the funding package. Hmm. I think there's just one little footnote I want to note here as we look at challenges and opportunities, and it's more on the challenges front. And, you know, it's easy to look at COVID-19 as a sort of shock. It was something that happened very fast. Largely unexpected, although I would say it wasn't entirely unexpected. We knew that something like this would happen at some point. We just didn't know what it would be or how it would show up. But nonetheless, the fact that so much has changed so fast, it's definitely a shock. But shocks are the only kind of challenge that we face when it comes to systemic fragility and instability. Longer term trends are another one. And so I sort of look at the difference between shocks and trends. Right? Two great trends are climate change and population growth, right? These are both going to have a massive effect on our food systems. Trends are more kind of like slow burning pressure points, whereas shocks are more like you just ratchet the temperature up in an instant. And trends are easier to ignore because their full impact isn't necessarily felt today, but we know they're there. We know they're important to address. And yet all too often we ignore them until crisis hits and we're sort of in triage mode. Today, I look at it and I think, you know, the food system isn't particularly well adapted to either shocks or trends. And I say this, you know, very big picture. So it's fragile whether we look at today in the light of COVID or whether we look at 2050 and expected population growth. But at the same time, I look at that and I go, okay, so that means there's just that much more opportunity, short-term, medium-term, and long-term, for food system stakeholders to pursue.
Yeah, Maria, I'm really interested for you to fill in at this point on, you know, what are some of these emerging challenges, or if you want to call them opportunities in disguise, that could have an impact on the sustainability of our planet's food supply.
Sure. We have certainly learned a lot in the past couple of months, and some of those insights may not be new to us, but for sure they're bringing focus on what needs to be done with urgency and with utmost priority. Echoing what April has said, I would also like to highlight, as perhaps the number one observation, is the flexibility of our supply chains. Our food supply chains have been built to be highly efficient, just in time, and mightily globalized. Just to put things into perspective, we have approximately 1 month of inventory in the US system. This is amazing for a country of this size. But this crisis has brought to focus the need to build a system that is more flexible and more resilient and can show agility when agility is required. The second learning is that of how we depend on total capabilities, and that is people, systems, and processes to run our food system, our food chains efficiently and deliver food to people, food that is safe, food that is nutritious, and food that can be economically distributed. We have done a really good job considering the complexity of the supply chains. We have done a very good job with food safety. But what this crisis is highlighting is the importance to step up our capabilities when it comes to employee health and safety in the workplace. And in combination, to put those two together to make sure that the production system is robust all the way from the first mile to the last mile. The third lesson is the changing behaviors of consumers and societies at large. We don't know yet how these changes will pan out. But what we do know is that consumers are changing. They're forced to change. So we have seen a lot of evolution in drivers for consumer behavior over the past 10 to 15 years, from a society that was primarily focused on value. We have seen a shift to values. So products that used to fulfill the consumer needs in terms of quality and cost, that's not sufficient anymore. People want to know more about their product. They want to know that the brand and the manufacturer of the brand, they actually have values, and they practice those values. It's interesting to see how this is going to pan out, because we are going through a recession. We are seeing a lot of poverty, as April mentioned. We are seeing now levels of unemployment and really socioeconomic strife that we have not seen in recent history. So it is fair to assume that consumers will be looking for value. They will be looking for low cost. But it is difficult to imagine that people will abandon the values and the need to trust the food that they eat, because we have seen this this trend build up steadily for a number of years now. So as we move through this crisis and coming out of this crisis, it is very important to keep in mind value and values.
I think that's a great point for us to end on, Maria, and really thank you both for this thought-provoking discussion. Listeners, we will have a second discussion with April and Maria, where we'll examine the world in flux, where we may be headed in light of ongoing change, and potential impacts to the global food system. And if you're enjoying Food Disruptors, please let us know by leaving a review on iTunes or by connecting with IFT. You can find us at IFT on Twitter and by searching the Institute of Food Technologists on Facebook and LinkedIn. Thanks for listening to Food Disruptors. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden. Have a great day, everyone.